Hello, I'm Amanda Jezik, IDSA's Senior Vice President for Public Policy and Government Relations. Welcome to IDSA's COVID-19 podcast series that aims to keep IDSA members, medical professionals, and the public informed during this pandemic by talking with experts in the field of infectious diseases. In this episode, we'll be talking with Dr. Archana Chatterjee of Rosalind Franklin University and Dr. Myron Cohen of the University of North Carolina on COVID-19 vaccines and prevention in immunocompromised individuals. Thank you both for joining us today. Dr. Chatterjee, can you tell us who is considered to be moderately or severely immunocompromised?
I think it's important that we first define what immunocompromised means. This means that a person has a weakened immune system. And that could be for many reasons. It could be because they are born with that. So very young children can have weakened immune systems. It can also be because someone is receiving treatment for a certain type of illness, such as cancer, or they've had an organ transplant or something like that. And actually, the immune system in humans weakens as it goes along, as people grow older. So in fact, people who are otherwise healthy, their immune systems might not work as well as they grow older beyond a certain age, 60, 65 and above. And so the recommendations with regard to managing COVID vaccinations, for example, vary depending on the status, the immune status of various individuals at the various stages of their life and based on what their underlying health condition might be. So when we talk about moderate to severely immunocompromised, because that's the language that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, uses to define who needs to receive extra doses of vaccines, it's actually available on the CDC's website, so people can look it up. But I'll just go through the list very quickly with you. It includes people receiving active cancer treatments for tumors or cancers of the blood, people who have received an organ transplant or are taking medications to suppress the immune system, people who've received a stem cell transplant within 2 years, people who have a moderate or severe primary immunodeficiency. These are the people who are born with these conditions, such as DeGeorge syndrome, Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, et cetera. Anyone with advanced or untreated HIV infection, and anyone being treated with high doses of corticosteroids or other drugs that may suppress their immune response. Important to note that if people don't fit into these categories, they still should talk to their healthcare provider to make sure if they are considered in some way severely or moderately immunocompromised and they're just not on this list.
Not all the hosts are created the same, or not all the defects are the same. And in the universe of our discussion this morning, we have to pay particular attention to people who are receiving drugs that might interfere with the function of B cells. Because in the end of the day, we're supposed to be talking about vaccination as well. And if there are many drugs where people might not think of themselves as compromised, but they're taking a drug that affects their ability to make antibodies. And that would be a huge blow to the success of a vaccine. So while the CDC has laid out for us very nicely a constellation of people to consider, I would add to it the special concern about people whose B cells will not work to make antibodies.
Are there particular considerations for what it means for children to be immunocompromised?
Some children are born with conditions that place them at increased risk for moderate to severe disease related to COVID, because their immune systems don't work well. Dr. Cohen mentioned people whose B cells, these are a type of lymphocyte, a type of blood cell. There are children who are born with a condition known as agammaglobulinemia. They basically don't make any antibodies at all. Those children would be considered at severe risk from this infection. Now, there are very, very few of those. You know, these are very rare conditions. In my career, I've only seen one or two of these children, but they are there. And so it's important for people to recognize that even very young children can have immunocompromising conditions.
Dr. Cohen, how well are immunocompromised individuals doing with COVID-19 vaccines?
Well, there's been a really, really big effort to understand this. The bottom line is a substantial number of people we're calling immunocompromised, when they receive a vaccine, can have a positive immune response. And generally, it's been recommended, at first it was, well, why don't you get the two shots? And then there was the original booster shot. And then subsequently, for this particular population, a fourth dose is recommended. Now, and so the good news is a substantial, depending on the underlying host defense defect, a substantial number of people will respond. But a problem that we're going to get into in our discussion is it's very hard for us to predict who has responded and who has not responded. So once you put yourself in the category of risk, we strongly suggest you get vaccinated for a variety of reasons, but that you also recognize that's not a passport to behavior changes that might put you at greater risk. Now, even the most severely immunocompromised person, depending on the vaccine they receive, may have a T cell response. And we've not really been able to sort out the contribution of T cells very well relative to the antibodies that we know are neutralizing for the virus. I guess the best summary is people at risk should be vaccinated. Right now, everyone's recommended of 3 shots, a 4th shot recommended for the population we're talking about this morning. And I would just say one last thing, and that is the dosage schedules are going to come into play. We really, and I was involved in the original vaccine development, we really made the original dosage schedules based on urgency, not immunology. We paid a price for that. And so I think for the physicians or healthcare providers listening, realize when the dosage schedules are changed, it's not out of ignorance, it's out of learning.
With regard to the dosing, it's very confusing because it's different depending on age. So for example, children who are 5 to 11 years old are actually recommended to receive 3 doses of one of the mRNA vaccines if they are considered moderate to severely immunocompromised. The 4 doses that Dr. Cohen is referring to are for children who are older than 12 and above, and also adults who have those conditions. With the vaccine that is not mRNA-based, there are actually 3 doses that are recommended. And the intervals that Dr. Cohen was talking about, those are different as well. So I always tell people, you know, we have, Dr. Cohen and I receive these calls from our colleagues who are physicians asking about their patients. What I tell them is, please look it up on the CDC's website if this is not something that you do on a regular basis, because that will give you the correct guidance, the current guidance on how these vaccines are supposed to be used for your patient.
This is going to change. So you can't see this as written in stone. Like diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, that's been around a long time. These vaccines are like we built an airplane while flying, and we're learning as we go along, and things are going to change. We anticipate very soon, at least in the United States, that a 4th dose will be recommended for people who are older because of the immunosenescence, the waning of a good immune response as you get older. So I just think we have to anticipate change and not be upset by it.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Cohen, I get questions quite often from the public asking about additional doses for otherwise healthy people. And in fact, I got asked recently by somebody about an application made to the FDA for 4th doses for both the mRNA vaccines. As you say, this is science and evolution. These vaccines are being studied as we are using them. And we've had to do that in the face of a deadly pandemic. So I think that this is important for people to understand that as the science advances, we make changes to the vaccination schedule, to the dosing, to the dosing intervals, depending on what we find out about how long the antibodies last, are we seeing breakthrough serious infections, things like that.
Hello, my name is Dr. Mati Tlachwayo-Davis. I'm the associate editor for the COVID Health Equity Resources section of the COVID-19 Real-Time Learning Network. The COVID Health Equity Resources section offers a collection of educational and training materials, research articles, and resources that are curated to help medical professionals and institutions provide equitable COVID-19 care. Check us out at idsociety.org/COVID-19 Real-Time Learning Network /COVID Health Equity Resources.
Dr. Cohen, can you tell us more about what happens to the virus in individuals who are moderately or severely immunocompromised?
This has been really well studied, and it kind of lends itself to a description of what transpires with COVID. So I'm going to be a little didactic just for a minute. An otherwise healthy person or a compromised person acquires COVID in their nose, generally by intimate close contact with someone else who's infected. And then what happens is the virus is going to start replicating as rapidly as it's possible in the nose. For the healthy host, they're going to make antibodies that are going to prevent the further growth of the virus. These are called neutralizing antibodies, and also prevent the virus from being aspirated into the lung. And so that otherwise healthy person's antibodies, their own autologous antibodies, are going to protect them. Now, the person who's been vaccinated has a head start. They've already got some antibodies available. They've got B cells ready to see the virus, and that head start's critically important. That's why most people do very, very well with COVID, and that's important. On the other hand, sporadically, some people don't make antibodies fast enough or don't make antibodies at all in the case of the compromised host, and the virus is allowed to keep replicating. And when the virus keeps replicating, it creates havoc. It's aspirated into the lung and causes pneumonia and then causes inflammation that leads to blood clots and severe disease. Now, in the compromised host, they have this big disadvantage, as I've already described. So the virus keeps replicating, and as it's continuing to replicate, it will wreak personal havoc. The person will remain contagious for longer periods of time, and the virus will, in many cases, find ways to evolve to greater strength. Because whatever selective pressure is being put on the virus, even in the compromised host, is enough to cause multiple mutations. And so there's a lot of disadvantages in the ongoing replication in the compromised host.
In children especially, Amanda, we see this, where children who've undergone transplants, for example, if they become infected with other viruses, like the influenza virus or the respiratory syncytial virus, RSV as we call it, these viruses, these children can continue to shed for weeks and even months on end. And those viruses, thankfully, don't undergo the changes that Dr. Cohen was describing. So some viruses mutate more than others. And with influenza, for example, those mutations don't typically happen as much in the human. They actually happen in the animal hosts. But with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, this virus mutates, and we've actually seen many studies that have reported that in the same patient, if you sample that patient over time and they're shedding the virus, you can actually see the evolution of these mutations occurring in real time in that one patient. And of course, if that patient then ends up transmitting that virus to other people, they would then get this mutated virus and they might get actually sick from that. So I think it's important to understand that this virus behaves in a way that's a little bit different than other viruses, and that it actually continues to change in a single host, as well as changing as it's being transmitted among different hosts.
And this discussion kind of emphasizes the point of why we're so concerned about providing interruption of viral replication in compromised hosts, or prevention altogether. For example, we're participating in a large study in South Africa of trying to understand, can we effectively vaccinate HIV-infected people? Earlier, Dr. Chatterjee pointed out such hosts, people with HIV infection, can be compromised, depending on their CD4 count of how advanced their disease is. And so these vaccine studies for compromised hosts are important, not just for the person, but for public health, to try and prevent the evolution of mutation. And as I said, there's a lot of ongoing interest and studies in this area. And one of the strategies that we might forget to mention, one strategy that NIH is pursuing is taking people whose immunosuppression can be interrupted and trying to vaccinate them during a window of interruption and then restart the immunosuppression. And so this is a strategy that is being pursued. Now, not every person can interrupt their immunosuppression, but for many diseases, this is possible, and it's probably worth noting that that is something being pursued.
And clinically, Dr. Cohen, we do this, right? So if we have a patient who has a serious infection, and they're also what we call iatrogenically immunosuppressed, so we're giving them some medication to suppress their immune system, sometimes we will lift that. We'll actually decrease the amount of immunosuppression for a brief period of time to allow their immune system to help us fight that infection. So that is a well-known tactic that we actually utilize to manage patients who have immunosuppression and have serious infections.
For individuals who are immunocompromised, is there utility in antibody testing to assess their immune response and a potential need for additional COVID-19 vaccine doses? And where do you think we are in terms of having good correlates of protection?
People think that if we measure antibodies, which we're able to do, that somehow we can tell if somebody has protection or not. The problem is quite complex here again. As Dr. Cohen mentioned, what we want to know is about neutralizing antibodies. We may have other antibodies that don't necessarily neutralize the virus. And so that's one thing. The second thing is that we don't have what we call a serologic correlate of protection, which is how high do your antibody titers need to be in order to protect you? Now, there are emerging data, and Dr. Cohen, I'm sure, will talk about that here in a moment, that indicate that if you have a certain level of antibodies, you know, we know a level, say, of 5,000 might be better than a level of 500, but we really don't have a cutoff. We do for other viruses. So for example, for hepatitis B, we know that if you have an antibody value of 10 international units or higher in your blood, you're going to be protected from that virus. We don't have those kind of very specific data for this virus. Dr. Cohen, your thoughts on this topic?
The first issue is, if you go get a commercial antibody test and it's positive, it simply means that you saw the vaccine. It doesn't mean that the vaccine provided you sufficient protection from infection, that you should take this, again, as a proof of immunity. We just don't have that right now. If you look at it that way, a positive test is good. A negative test means I better continue to worry about this. That's the first point. The second point has to do with, well, okay, I've been vaccinated. I feel better for that purpose, but I better think of what my other alternatives are. And another alternative I want to bring up that is informative is monoclonal antibodies. So very early, before we ever had vaccines, we were developing monoclonal antibodies, and there are lots of them out there already. But in the context of our discussion of prevention, we know that Evusheld, the combination of antibodies made by AstraZeneca, that when provided passively can provide sustained prevention of infection. And that sustained prevention can be correlated with the concentration of that monoclonal antibody in the blood. In addition, Regeneron, when Delta was still around, and Evusheld is effective against Omicron. So it remains an extremely important tool for compromised hosts who need a belt and suspenders. They've been vaccinated and they need Evusheld. So I think that's quite an important drug. And there'll be other drugs like that. That's just the first out there. With Regeneron's drug, RegenCov, when Delta was still around, when we gave a single dose of that, we saw protection from infection for 5 months. And we saw the concentration of antibody that was required for that protection over 5 months. And in the sixth month, the antibody concentration had waned to the extent that infection surfaced. So this surrogate of immunity idea is doable. It's doable. And we just don't have it in the vaccine space at this point. Sufficiently, nor do we have the ability to measure it in every person who's been vaccinated, but we're learning a lot about it. Now, I know there's a lot more experience in children with RSV, for example, with some of these antibodies. So I'm going to ask Dr. Chatterjee about that.
So this concept is actually not new, Amanda, as Dr. Cohen was alluding to, for respiratory syncytial virus in very young children, particularly premature babies and infants who have some other underlying medical conditions like a congenital heart disease, for example. These children have very bad outcomes sometimes with RSV infection. And so we have been trying to prevent RSV infection in this population for a very long time, but for many decades, actually. We do not have a vaccine for RSV yet. Those have been in development over decades, and we haven't come up with one yet. But as Dr. Cohen mentioned, we do have monoclonal antibodies that have been in use. There's one called pilivazumab, which has been used for a very long time. It's a shorter acting monoclonal antibody, so you need multiple injections to be given over the RSV season. RSV tends to be a seasonal virus in most of the United States. But we have a newer one, nirsevimab, which has that prolonged protection that it provides against that virus. And it needs only a single injection. So as Dr. Cohen was pointing out, we've used these tactics before, and we're now applying something very similar to COVID and to prevention of COVID, particularly in the population of interest here, which is the moderate to severely immunocompromised hosts.
So this kind of discussion we've had to date kind of brings us to a kind of turning point in a way. And it brings us to the idea that we have an integrated strategy to prevent infection in compromised hosts. We have masks. We know they work. And we don't want to cause disinhibition of use of masks for people who are at risk of progression disease. We have vaccines, and we know they work in many compromised hosts, but not all. And then where appropriate, depending on the underlying host defense defect, we have monoclonal antibodies that will last at least 6 months. So we have tools to help the compromised hosts succeed at prevention of COVID.
While our discussion today is not focused on treatment, but I think it's also important to recognize that there are antiviral medications that can be given if these patients are identified early. There's testing available, particularly antigen testing, which is very, very helpful to quickly identify patients who might need treatment with those antiviral agents. It's important that we mention that, that people realize that while we try to prevent the infection as much as possible, if people who are immunocompromised do become infected, there's treatments available for them.
I completely agree. And maybe we should extend this into a more granular discussion, because I really think it is important. So we've done everything we can do for prevention of infection. But I think for somebody who's worried about this, that, and rightly worried, and the healthcare provider worried, it's not enough. So the development of rapid tests that can be deployed at home and are now widely available, familiarity and availability and familiarity with the rapid test for somebody who's compromised is completely appropriate. And then for the drugs we have to prevent progression of disease, I'm going to be more specific in a second, time matters. Earlier, we talked about replication of the virus in the nose. That unremitting replication has many consequences, including almost certainly contribution to long COVID. So we want to stop the replication of the virus. So as was noted, we have kind of two flavors of interruption of progression of disease. One flavor are, again, monoclonal antibodies. That's what they were originally developed for, but they really work best when given immediately upon recognition of infection. And they're the ones that still work against Omicron, include a drug from Vir called sotrovimab, and include a drug from Lilly called bebtelovimab. And we can make monoclonal antibodies really, really quickly. This is the contribution of HIV to COVID. We know how to do this. So, but the problem is we have to give those sub-Q or by infusion. And so there's an automatic delay. Now, the alternative is what President Biden described in his State of the Union address. In his mind, it was like, okay, you can drive up to a pharmacy, do a rapid test. The rapid test is positive. You're symptomatic. The rapid test is positive. And a bottle of pills is handed to you. And we have two kinds of pills that are available to us. One drug made by Pfizer, which is going to be available in very large supply, it's called Paxlovid. And we know that the government has invested in buying a huge supply of this drug for the United States and for other countries. The second drug is made by Merck, and it's called Molnupiravir. And that drug, in its clinical trial, did not perform as well as we anticipated, but is being used at the same pace as Paxlovid, because Paxlovid is a little harder to use because you have to look at all the other drugs somebody's on. But the bottom line of this very long dissertation is that the person who finds themselves at risk for progression disease, and they've done everything they can for prevention, we need to make them, they and their provider, familiar with the treatment options. And many are not familiar with the treatment options and see it as too difficult. And within the universe of these treatment options, we need to create no delay. It's the no delay is really important to get the maximal benefit of the agents we've developed.
Many of these medications are also available for use in children. Our colleagues in the infectious disease world, we are more than happy to assist our other physician colleagues who may not be as familiar with these treatments to help them take care of their patients. So if they have a patient, this is not routinely what they do, this is not routinely how they conduct their practice, there's almost always an infectious disease physician somewhere available to them to consult, to help them manage their patients. And I would recommend, because these are so complex, and like we talked about earlier, this science is also evolving. New medications, new monoclonal antibodies are continuously being developed and made available. And it's difficult even for us to keep track of all of those. And so certainly I would recommend that any physician who needs assistance with this should seek that from our infectious disease colleagues to make sure that the best treatment is available for their patients.
There remains in this space a big unknown. The big unknown is as follows. We know that about a third of people who get COVID, depending on age and other parts of their health profile, a third will have some sort of chronic symptoms. There may be a chronic cough, maybe cardiovascular complications, maybe central nervous system complications. It's a huge literature evolving. I was at Yale when Lyme disease was first discovered, and every day there was another part of Lyme disease uncovered. You know, it went from one thing to another thing to another thing. That's what's happening with COVID. But what we don't, we see nascent clues that vaccination reduces the probability of long COVID. These are just hints. If the pills and the antibodies you're talking about prevent long COVID, then their role in their deployment becomes entirely different. Because since anyone can get long COVID, you can envision in the future COVID as an endemic disease being treated much more aggressively, not because people are going to be hospitalized, because you don't want to take the chance of long COVID. Now, this is forward-thinking hypothetical. This is, no one should believe that we have the data to support what I've just suggested might happen, but it's something we're studying.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kim Hansen. Advance the career of your colleagues by encouraging them to apply to become a fellow of IDSA. Visit idsociety.org/FIDSA.
You've both emphasized the importance of vaccination for immunocompromised individuals. And as you've discussed, vaccine dosing schedules and recommendations can be confusing and are likely to continue to change as we learn more. I really appreciated, Dr. Chatterjee, your point about how everyone should be relying on their infectious diseases specialist to help guide us through all of these challenging questions that people are grappling with. To close us out, can you clarify what are the current recommendations for COVID vaccines among immunocompromised adults and children? And how do those recommendations differ depending on whether someone initially received an mRNA vaccine, a J&J vaccine, or one of the vaccines available outside of the U.S.? So I know that's a lot, but if you can break down something for our listeners to start with to begin to understand the current recommendations.
I'll begin with the children. The CDC's website is a great site to go to check on how many doses people at different age groups need. But for the 5 to 11-year-olds, a primary series of 3 doses are recommended for moderate to severely immunocompromised children. For children who are older and teens, 12 and above, for the mRNA vaccines, the total number of doses is 4, with 3 primary doses given. And then for the adults, it's the same. With the J&J vaccine, it's recommended that people who got that vaccine should get 3 doses. That's the total of 3 doses for the moderate to severely immunocompromised. So for people who have received their vaccines overseas, the recommendations are actually quite complex. And again, the CDC does have recommendations for these. I typically recommend that people look at that website and see how they should vaccinate those individuals, because the vaccines they received in other countries are not necessarily available here. One other point I'd like to make before I hand it off to Dr. Cohen, and that is about the people who are around these folks who are moderate to severely immunocompromised. So these are family members, maybe other people that they're in contact with. It's critically important that those people also get vaccinated, because a lot of the time, the risk of infection for the immunocompromised is from someone who is around them, who's in their family that they're in contact with. So we call it the cocoon strategy in pediatrics. We use it for whooping cough vaccination, actually, where we can't vaccinate very young children, but we can vaccinate their parents and their grandparents and their caregivers. And it's the same strategy that can be used here and should be used, so that we vaccinate everybody who's around that immunocompromised individual to provide that that cocoon around them, if you will, that layer of protection that's given by those people being protected as well.
That last point's a great point, because if you look at households, if one person in the household is infected, the probability that other people are either symptomatically or asymptomatically infected is very, very high, certainly greater than 50%. I think the only thing I'd add, you asked a really complicated question, a question too complicated for any known podcast, in my opinion. So having said that, I very much appreciate Dr. Chatterjee saying, well, look at the CDC website. And the reason that's important is not ducking the conversation. It's because whatever is today may not be tomorrow. Okay. And it's really important to see what the most current recommendations are that are aggregated by the groups at the CDC who are working on this problem. And this is particularly important for compromised hosts, because the vaccine series timing is in play. At first, it was like, here's what you're supposed to do. You take 2 doses, 3 or 4 weeks apart, and then you wait 6 months, and then you maybe wait another 6 months. But those timeframes are really not correct. And so what's going on now is to reduce the boosters as much as possible while securing the best possible immune response. And we certainly don't have any idea how many boosters people are supposed to get, right? We're talking about a fourth shot now for people who are compromised and probably for people who are going to be over 65. And that may or may not be the last shot. That's a whole other discussion. And that next shot may or may not be with the vaccines we're using now. And lastly, you didn't ask a question that we call mix and match, that I get every day. I took 3 doses of the Pfizer vaccine. What's my next vaccine? Should I take the Moderna vaccine or the reverse? And there's no absolute right answer to that, but it does appear that mixing sometimes gives somewhat greater immunity. We don't see a disadvantage in mixing, but that's another, that is 3 doses of Pfizer and 1 dose of Moderna, or 2 doses of Moderna. This is not written in its own. This is an option available to the healthcare provider. But I do think that the recommendation to look today at the CDC website, which I myself would do, if I was going to, every day I would look and not trust that what happened yesterday was still the exact same recommendations today.
At this time, I'd like to thank Drs. Chatterjee and Cohen for their time, participation, and expertise. For the latest information and resources on the COVID-19 pandemic, visit IDSA's website, idsociety.org, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Tune in next time as another diverse panel of medical experts discusses the latest on COVID-19.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Involvement of CDC should not be viewed as endorsement of any entity or individual involved with the podcast.